I'm Lillian Vasquez with Lifestyles on KVCR. Thanks for listening. November is National Diabetes Awareness Month. So on today's show, I'll speak with young country music artist Ben Rue, who is living with diabetes. Ben learned of his diabetes at the age of 14. He'll share his story and how he's pushing to create awareness with the campaign #BuckOffDiabetes. And we'll talk about his music journey. But first, I'll speak with Executive Director Jessica Munoz with the Riverside County program Voices for Children. They oversee the CASA program for Riverside County. CASA stands for Court Appointed Special Advocate. It's coming up on Lifestyles with me, Lillian Vasquez, right after the NPR newscast. Lifestyles. I'm Lillian Vasquez. CASA is the court-appointed special advocate program working to transform lives of abused, abandoned, and neglected children. Voices for Children is a nonprofit operating the CASA program in Riverside County. My guest is Jessica Munoz. She's the executive director for the Riverside County program Voices for Children. Welcome and thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me what it is your organization does.
Voices for Children is the court-appointed special advocate, or CASA, program for Riverside County. Our organization has the unique privilege to recruit, train, and support very special volunteers who are appointed by judges to advocate for individual children or even sibling groups who are in foster care.
Would one go through to become an advocate or part of the CASA program?
All of our advocates are volunteers, and we recruit volunteers from across Riverside County. The first step to becoming a court-appointed special advocate, or CASA as we say, is to attend an information session. And we offer information sessions in Temecula, Riverside, and Coachella Valley monthly. And information gives a prospective volunteer a chance to learn a little bit more about the role of a CASA, the expectations that we have of our volunteers, and of course the expectations that we anticipate our volunteers will have in terms of the support that we provide for them. After someone decides that they're interested in pursuing becoming a CASA volunteer, they interview with a member of our staff, complete background checks, as you can imagine, because we do serve children, and also complete 35 hours of training. Upon successful completion of all of those steps, our volunteers are then appointed by a judge to a child in foster care to advocate in their best interests.
And what does that really look like when they advocate for their best interests?
So boys and girls in foster care are children who have been abused or neglected or abandoned and have been removed from their homes for their safety, and so that in many cases services can be provided for their family. And while there are many very, very dedicated and committed professionals like social workers and attorneys and judges who are working to serve these children, many of the people in the child's life are also managing very challenging caseloads. And so that's where a CASA volunteer really steps in and can make a tremendous impact. Because they're volunteers, CASAs advocate and serve one child or one sibling group at a time. From the child's perspective, having a CASA looks like having a consistent and reliable adult that he or she can count on to visit them, to check in on them, to take them on outings and get to know them potentially, can attend back to school night at their school, spend all sorts of time with the child and really get to know them. From the court's perspective, the value in having a CASA volunteer is that now there's someone involved who really does have this holistic, very unique perspective of the child's life and hopes and wishes and dreams, and has the platform to be able to share that information with the court and the social worker and the attorneys and others who are making decisions about the child's life.
So give me an example of what an advocate would do, or maybe a success story, so we get a better understanding of their role.
Sure. We want a diverse cadre of volunteers because the children that we serve are diverse. So in one scenario, we had a CASA who was assigned to advocate for a young lady who was in her teens. This was a young woman who lived in a group home and had no one visiting her on a regular basis except for her CASA. Her CASA would take her on brief outings. They might go to ice cream or to an afternoon in a park. And while the young lady appreciated having the caring consistency of her CASA, because the CASA was spending time with her, she was also able to make observations about her needs. And many of our children that we serve haven't had a lot of stability in terms of their education, and oftentimes haven't really had someone motivating them and encouraging them to do well in school. And in some of these cases, CASA volunteers, in addition to their role, are even assigned by the judge to hold educational rights. So in a situation like this, the CASA, who now has this very unique and sort of caring perspective of the child's circumstances, can advocate for her to have special resources in school, for her to have special services. In this particular case, was even the very first person who ever talked to her about college being an option, and they spent one of their visits walking around the college, and it was really impactful to this young lady to have someone who she respected and had come to depend on say to her, "I think you have what it takes to pursue anything that you want, and I see the potential in you." Where a CASA's impact can be particularly significant is not only does the CASA have the ability to look into the child's eyes and tell them what they see and how much potential they believe that they have, the CASA can also advocate in court for the child to have the services or resources necessary for the child to be able to have the support they need to achieve the potential that the CASA sees.
My guest is Jessica Munoz. She's the executive director for the Riverside County program, Voices for Children. When someone becomes an advocate and they're with one person, one child, how long are they with that child? What's the range?
So we ask CASAs to go into their role with the idea that they're making an 18-month commitment to a child. Many of our CASA volunteers choose to stay with their children longer, and in fact, we have about a dozen volunteers in Riverside County now who've been serving their children for 3 years or more.
Is this relatively new to our community? CASA's been around a while.
That's right. So the CASA model started in Seattle in the late 70s, and nationwide now there are nearly 1,000 CASA programs. Voices for Children has had the privilege of serving Riverside County as its CASA program since 2014, and we're incredibly proud of the remarkable volunteers that have stepped up from the community to be able to serve children across Riverside County. We went from serving a couple of dozen children in that first year to having served more than 350 children last year in Riverside County. And we really owe that to our volunteers and their dedication.
Very good. Jessica, thanks so much for your time. Enjoyed what you're doing and how you're serving our local community.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
To learn more about Voices for Children, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. Up next, it's my interview with Ben Rue, an artist I had never heard of, and now I'm loving his music. You're listening to Lifestyles. I'm Lillian Vasquez.
I just turned my head when I see.
Ben Rue is a country singer and recently performed at the One Night for Our Military concert in Burbank. But today we're talking about his country music career. And I have to tell you, Ben, I had never heard of you, but I love your music. I went and listened as I researched for this interview, and I totally love it. I'm so looking forward to sharing your music with my daughter. So welcome. Thank you for being a guest.
Well, thank you for having me, Lily. Yeah, I'm glad you like what you hear, and please share with anyone. I appreciate it.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. What's your story and where'd you grow up?
Yeah, well, I'm from Oregon. I grew up on a family farm out there. My dad still works on it with my two older brothers, and my mom's a nurse. That was my summer, driving combine every summer for about 10 years.
Okay. When did you start singing and writing songs, and what were your early subject matters?
Actually, my mom plays 5 or 6 instruments herself. So she had always tried to get us kids into playing music, piano, and And we always wanted to play sports, but I did a couple insane talent show when I was sixth grade. That was my first, like, real performance, which I try to forget. But it was fun, and I didn't really get into writing music, though, until I was in college. My brother plays a little guitar, too, and I like to think I can do anything he can. So I started playing guitar and writing a couple songs. They weren't very good, but you got to start somewhere.
And when you started playing guitar, were you taking lessons? Were you following your brother, your mom? How did you learn to play?
You know, it's amazing what you can learn from YouTube. I would go on YouTube and learn a few chords, and you can play thousands and thousands of songs by just three chords. And so I learned three chords and then started learning a few songs. Wrote a couple, learned a few more chords, and, you know, then kind of opened up the rest of the doors for me.
You never would have guessed that YouTube would have been your first instructor.
Well, it's a lot cheaper in college, too, than going and hiring someone to help you.
You left baseball, or baseball left you, whichever way you play that. You're in college, you're playing music. Are you one of those guys that ever formed a band and played somewhere just to see if you could entertain somebody?
Yes, so my first band was a couple guys from my baseball team, and we would write songs in the computer lab, and they were terrible songs, but it was still fun, and there's a surveillance camera in the computer lab. We would always have our rehearsals under surveillance, and so our band name then hence was Under Surveillance, and it lasted for about a year. We just did, like, little coffee shops around, but, you know, it was just kind of an icebreaker to me as an artist, and writing songs and forming a little band. It was fun.
Let's talk about some of your music and some of the titles of your songs. You either must really have fun with your music. I mean, I hate Chevys. My husband is probably, veins are probably popping out with the fact that that's the name of a song, or Let Him Loose, Making Out, Better Bartender. So tell me about your music.
You know what, though, with some of those songs, the thing about songwriting is finding ways to say something different than anyone's ever heard, or spinning words in a different way. So I hate Chevys. It's so funny when I say that title. Chevy fans around the house are always like, boo, you know.
Yeah,
I bet.
But
if you actually listen to the song, it's all about how Chevys run well, and how this girl, like, she's never coming back because her Chevy's never going to break down. I mean, she's just going.
Right.
And so it's funny when, you know, when they hear the through the first chorus, they're like, okay, I got you. But in Making Out, the same way, it's just spinning a phrase that you hear often in another way. And so, yeah, that's the beauty of songwriting, is finding ways to say things differently.
I listened to all those songs because you're right. I Hate Chevy wasn't really about hating Chevys by any means, but the title of it was quite catchy.
It's supposed to grab your attention, too, so.
And it did. Your voice and your storytelling, I think, really work. I'm speaking with Ben Rue, country singer and songwriter. Let's talk about your relationship with diabetes. It is National Diabetes Month, and I know you've lived with it. How did you first learn? Why were you tested?
My mother was a nurse. She's retired now, but she used to bring home little gadgets to test on us kids for fun. So one day she brought home a glucometer from work, and randomly my brothers were normal, 80 to 110, 120, whatever it is, and mine was 555. So I remember very distinctively, like, I win, you know, that's the high score. I beat them. But I knew she kind of got serious, and, you know, she had a kind of a tear swell up in her eye, and she was like, we need to go to the doctor tomorrow. And I was like, all right, that's not good. Something's about to change.
Right. Now, I don't know enough about diabetes, so I'm happy that you're answering the questions, but had she not tested, what would you have seen later, or are there signs? Describe mm-hmm. that for me.
You know, I would imagine, and this is not, I don't have any facts to back this up, but most people that I would imagine that find out they're diabetic, they typically get sick, and they have to go to the doctor's office for different reasons. There's different symptoms. So there's a wide range of symptoms for that, but it's just involves them not feeling well. Peeing a lot, honestly, is one of them. Having used the bathroom a lot, like, and then just feeling overall just not well. And so that's probably what would have happened, you know, whether that was a day down the road, a week down the road. I have no idea how long I was diabetic before we found out either. So it was definitely a God thing to find out the way I did.
And how old were you when you first learned?
I was 14.
Wow.
14 years old, yeah.
Middle school,
going to high
school.
Trying to make friends was a little tough for me. You know, you kind of have to learn quickly with diabetes because it's an everyday thing. I guess that's why this whole campaign that I'm with AccuCheck Guide, the Buck Off Diabetes campaign, you know, works so well because I have some experience. Not that I have all the answers, but I can share my story with kids who are 14 or younger or are learning how to live with this new thing.
All right, we'll talk about the campaign in just a second. I want to ask you, when you first were diagnosed and you started high school, what changes did you have to make to your life that early in high school and then on to college and playing sports? What adjustments did you have to do?
Well, I mean, at that point in anyone's mind, you think your life's over. I mean, I thought I was never going to be able to play sports again. I'm never going to be able to eat my favorite foods again because all I think is just I just have to eat vegetables and non-carbs the rest of my life. But, you know, it's one of those things that everyone has their issues in life. It's how you handle it that sets you apart. So
right.
With diabetes, it's all about managing. So I'll have to test my blood sugar 6 to 10, 12 times a day, depending on what I'm doing or exercising. But it's an evolving thing that you kind of have to learn to live with. But, you know, I promise you, any person out there that's struggling with it, you'll figure it out. You'll find your routine and your stride, and you'll be just fine.
You were involved as a youth. You went to camp and then later became a counselor. How was that camp experience for you as a youngster?
I mean, that was pivotal. That was the moment I realized that I wasn't in this alone. I grew up in a small town in Silverton, Oregon, and there was maybe one other person that had diabetes, but I didn't really know them. And so I just had this feeling of being alone, that no one really understood what I was doing. But this camp that I went to, there's 65, 70 kids from all around the country that are living with what I am living with. But a lot of them are further along in their, you know, their journey with diabetes. And so they have a lot of experience to pass on to me. And that's the biggest thing about this, and is we're all in it together. You need to find your support group, because there's a lot more people out there than you think that are just like you. And don't be afraid to ask questions.
And do you think later when you were a counselor that you were able to pass that on to some of the younger kids that were feeling like their life was over?
I hope so. Yeah, I take that. That's very important to me to not just show up to camp for myself to have fun, but knowing that stuff that I say, experiences that I talk about, people are going to take home with them.
Sure.
You know, kids are going to take home with their parents and talk about. And yeah, I think it's super important to just be open with conversation and how you treat yourself, you know, what your daily routines are.
Okay, so let's talk about the campaign. What's the hashtag?
The hashtag is, it's Buck Off Diabetes.
Buck
and
Off?
Yeah, it's a
diabetes.
It's a fun play on words, yeah, but it's a national awareness program that embodies this bold new attitude for taking on diabetes. And working with my friends at AccuCheck Guide, traveling around the country, showing people how they can get involved by saving a buck and also donating a buck to a good cause.
And how do they go about doing that?
Yeah, thank you for asking. First, you can save a buck with the AccuCheck Guide Simple Pay Card, which you pay the same low price for testing strips, which I promise you is very crucial and important, because they can get expensive, but they don't have to be. And you can also donate a buck by taking your bullhorns in your hand. I don't know if you can. I'm trying to show you over the phone, but you can't see it.
I know. I'm making my hands here in the studio. If you could see me, the horns, right?
Yeah, I see you. And then you take a picture with your bullhorns, upload it to your social media with the hashtag BuckOffDiabetes. And for every post that goes up, Roche Diabetes Care will donate a buck to a diabetes-related organization.
Awesome. Well, I'll do it as soon as we get off the air.
Yeah, and for anyone, it's very easy, very simple. It takes 20 seconds out of your day, and, I mean, you're helping a good cause while you're doing it.
Well, thanks for that, and thanks for what you're doing there. I want to transition back to, you know, Oregon is a long way from Nashville. How did your family feel about the move and or the opportunity or the changes that were coming to your world?
I don't think they really knew, to be honest. You know, no one in my family had ever done anything like this. The thing about our small town is build your roots, hang out there, get married young, and build a family. And I kind of went a different route. And so we were all kind of learning it together. They definitely supported me, and they still do. You know, I'm kind of the crazy dreamer in the family. I've between going to school for a baseball scholarship, traveling cross country for baseball in Michigan, or picking up and traveling to Nashville for music, I kind of do things out of the norm. But we talk to each other probably 2-3 times a week, and they're always asking what's going on. They want to be in the know just as much as I do.
My guest is Ben Rue, country singer and songwriter. Were you ever singing in the fields?
Oh, gosh. So I started driving combine when I was about 11, full-time, 10, 12 hours a day. And so I would listen to Garth Brooks, Jody Messina, Alan Jackson, and just every station that I would have on quick dial, you know, would be every country station around the area. So when they'd go commercial, I'd switch to the next country station and just live for all those stories that people talked about in their songs, which is why I love country music so much. It's just the real stuff, the stories that, you know, are very unique.
Well, that's very similar to public radio, because public radio is about telling a story. What artists, you just named a few, were you listening to growing up, and was there any influence there from some of the artists that you just mentioned, or were there other artists that were influential?
Oh, totally, yeah. So I love, like I mentioned, story songs from Garth Brooks and Alan Jackson and George Strait, and I love the melodies of Diamond Rio, and even like Jody Messina is one of my favorite woman artists of all time. I mean, I listen to basically everything.
At this point in your career, which of your songs do you enjoy performing? I know you perform them all, you love them all, but which do you enjoy performing?
That's like asking who your favorite child is.
I know, but come on. Maybe because of the feedback from the audience, or the atmosphere that it creates in the room, which song does that for you or for your audience?
There's an artist friend of mine said something that made me think. Anyone can get a crowd riled up. Anyone can get a crowd screaming and yelling, but it's something else to get a crowd super quiet. And there's one song that I have called Hail Mary that I feel like I can silence a crowd, and they're listening, hanging on to every word. And that's a cool moment for me. It's just, you know, it's like I'm playing at the Bluebird in Nashville, you know, at these big venues, and it's all because they're just listening. They want to hear the song and the melody and where I'm going with it. And that's one of my favorite moments. So Hail Mary is probably one of my favorites to sing in front of a crowd for sure. I'm throwing up a
Hail Mary. Ben Rue is a country singer and songwriter. Thank you so much for your time and for your fun and entertaining music. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, Lillian. I appreciate it.
You can find the link to Ben Rue's website at our website, kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. For my full conversation with Ben Rue and to hear some of his music, listen to KVC Arts with David Fleming, November 28th at 7 p.m. That's our show. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. Thanks to all who helped to make this show possible, including David Fleming, Sharina Wadd, Sean Houlihan, and executive producer Rick Dulock. Ethan Bortnick provides our theme music. Thanks for listening. Join me next week at the same time for Lifestyles with me, Lillian Vasquez. Bye for now.